Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2020. I think this is the 12th night, although we've obviously had a break for Christmas Day and Boxing Day. And I hope you all had a nice Christmas, and I hope you spent it with family, friends, and had a good and nourishing time. But now we've got another three nights or four nights of Millennial. Hold on a second, I'll just confirm that. 27, 28, 29. Yeah, another four nights of Millennial starting. Now, tonight, I have four streams for you, and I should say that the final two will be DLive only, so you might want to subscribe to me on DLive, and I'll give you the link for that now. Hold on a second. Let's see. There we go.
Give the link.
There we go. They're in the live chat. So what's happening is 2 hours from now, I'll be speaking to an author about his book, Conquest by Concept. And then it'll be Half a Perspective, and then it'll be Mike Enoch. Those two on DLive only. But first, I have David McMurdo. So David McMurdo is a Scottish, and I've been aware of David for, I think, since the start of my channel. I think around about that time. Did you comment? Sorry, welcome to Millennial, David, and thank you for taking part.
Well, thank you. It's a great privilege to be here. And can I just ask the chat how your Christmas was? You see, the only way I can read the chat, which I like to do when I'm streaming, is to have the stream open myself. And so I've got Colin over here. I've got the chat there, webcam down there. That's why you'll see my eyes shifting about. But yes, I don't do many live streams, even though I get asked to do a lot. And maybe those in chat can tell me if they agree with this. My feeling is that when a live stream involves a group, say five or six people, it's very rarely productive because so many people don't know that interrupting and cutting people off just doesn't work on the internet, especially not when you've got a group of five or six people with different degrees of lag. And also because I don't necessarily make these choices myself. The spirit tells me when a certain occasion is going to be auspicious or not, and I do things based on that. And so, yes, just generally, I don't like talk. You know, I just even myself talking, I don't like that. I prefer silence, which is something we'll get into later on. But what those watching really have to appreciate is that I've been on YouTube since 2005. Colin, as you know, has been on YouTube for a very long time himself. But we are essentially complete strangers who have just so happened to interact maybe once every 2 years across the years. But Colin at least knows that I don't have a focus on politics and that I'm therefore not a part of the dissident right. And yet he has still allowed me to come on here and speak for an hour and a half. And that is very commendable because, as you well know, most YouTubers would not do that. And even though Colin and I really are strangers, maybe you remember differently, Colin, but I don't recall ever interacting with you as though you were a stranger. And I think that might be because I'm a very open person, and I know you are as well, and that's what your subscriber base really resonates with about you. But what I'm curious about is, I always thought Millennial was purely political. And then I saw your discussion with Munosity and I thought, oh, maybe it's not all politics after all. And what I'm wondering is, I've heard you say several times that this or that person would not be a good fit for Millennial. So who is someone that is not a good fit? What don't you want on Millennial? Just so I know, because I do these things off the cuff so I can adjust, you know, by style. What is not a good fit for Millennial?
Somebody who isn't inquisitive, I think. I wouldn't want somebody on who was just going to tell me that this is what I must believe and everyone else should believe this, that kind of thing. Also someone who was too political for that same reason, because I don't want people on who are just going to, you know, bark doctrine at the camera. I want people on who are doing things in real life, and or people who are thinking and curious. And So, yeah, I never wanted it. And I don't think I've ever wanted it to be purely political. But then I don't want the dissident right to be purely political. I want it to be full of, you know, creative and culturally active, culturally aware people. So, you know, that's what I see Millennial as, a sort of showcase of the movement of the dissident right. But, yeah, there are people on Millennial. I have people even outside of that ambit each year, you know, one or two. So, yeah, I think that really what I want Millennial to be is inspiring and interesting for people. So basically I have people on who are either inspiring or interesting to me, and I hope, and I just rely on that working for everyone else, for the audience.
Well, so it seems to be so far. As I said, I've been looking at the comments, and people seem to like this variety you've got. So I was wondering something about your discussion with Count Dankula, who I'm going to call Marcus from now on, because that's his name. You were talking to him about him being raised Catholic, and you, I believe, asked if he was Catholic himself, and he said no. He said his beliefs were more traditional than that. What did he mean by that?
I don't know. I took it to mean that he's some kind of pagan. That's what I took it to mean when he said that. But honestly, I didn't want to go into it at the time because it didn't seem appropriate, because I thought it would sort of spoil the flow of the conversation. So that's why I didn't ask him to clarify. But really, you would have to ask him yourself. I think it would be a very strange meeting to see a stream with you and Dankula. I've got to say.
Is there any chance he is burning tourists in a giant wicker man?
I don't know. Well, maybe Sky journalists. No, I don't think so.
Well, I found your discourse about Scotland really interesting, especially from a Highland perspective. And then towards the end, someone asked a question, you know, what is the difference between the Lowlands and the Highlands? I wouldn't say I'm as experienced with the Lowlands, so experienced that I could really offer a comparison myself. All I can do is testify of the Highlands, and this is something that might appeal to your nationalist base. Is that a good term, nationalist base or dissident right? Would that be more appropriate?
Yes, dissident. Well, I mean, yeah, I'm sort of, I don't know. It's not that I'm not a nationalist anymore. I find it a bit dry at this point. I find it a bit boring. But yeah, obviously it's still there, and it will always, I think it will always be there. So yeah, it's nationalist base. Yes. If you want to talk about the Highlands, I think that would be very interesting to people.
Well, you and Marcus, you got into the history of Scotland, and up here, there's a very interesting history because, of course, in the ancient world, you had this land dominated by the Pictish Confederation, which was a confederation of different Pictish tribes. Now, I live in a county called Caithness. It's right at the top of the Highlands of Scotland. And Caithness, the Cait part, is derived from cat. The Norse used to call this the land of the cat people, which presumably means that there was a tribe of Picts here that maybe they used cat imagery, or they had a tribal cat affiliation, I don't know. But there are a lot of wild cats up here, so it would make sense to me. Now, the town I live in, Thurso, it didn't exist at the time, in those ancient times with the Picts, but the river that runs through the town did, and the Picts called it Bull's River. Then what happened is the Norse came in, and they settled this region far north. And for those who don't know where Thurso is, and when I lived in Glasgow, absolutely no one knew where Thurso was. To give you some reference, it's right up beside John O'Groats, essentially 20 miles from John O'Groats. And so the Norse came in, and they called what the Picts called Bull River, Thor's River. And that's where the name of Thurso comes from, Thor's River. And so...
Right! So and this, is there a link?
This land is Pictish.
Hold on, is there a link with Kelso down at the borders? Thurso and Kelso?
I don't know, but I used to work in a call centre and people calling in would get that confused all the time. I honestly have no idea if there's a link at all.
All right.
But what you have is up here that this strange amalgamation or the strange mix, because you've got historically a Pictish land. You've got a Norse town to the extent that so many street names here are named after famous Viking warriors, for example. We also have every few years this, I don't know what you'd call it, a ceremony, a celebration where we pull a giant longship through the town and burn it, which is a replica of something that goes on in Shetland. From Thurso Beach, you can see the Orkney Isles, and beyond them are the Shetland Isles. And so the town itself is just steeped in the Norse. But of course, the people here, they identify as Scottish people. So for me, it was always strange growing up as someone who was conscious of these things, which of course most wouldn't be. But I never really felt Scottish, and I never really felt Norse. I honestly resonated more with the whole Pictish side of things. If you go down to the museum that's in this town, you'll see they've got the big Pictish stones there. So it's like you've got these three influences mixing together, and it's just a strange thing. And I always suspected that I had some Norse or Scandinavian DNA. I fully expected to have that, but as I said to you recently, I got my DNA tested with Ancestry of late, and it was 92% Highland Scottish, 5% Irish, and 3% Welsh. So I don't have any Scandinavian DNA at all, and somehow avoided getting any Anglo-Saxon DNA. So, yeah, that was a bit unusual, but we don't have the same kind of sectarianism that you and Marcus were talking about up here at all. I mean, if someone was attacked for that kind of reason up here, it would be very strange to people. But when I was 21, I moved down to Glasgow for a period because I'd met this woman that I was in a relationship with. Now, she was from Sardinia originally, but she'd lived in Glasgow long enough to know it very well. And so she was showing me about the city when I first moved down there. And at one point, she pointed me to this particular area, the name of which I've forgotten. But I lived out near Anniston towards the West End. But she pointed me to this particular area and she said, whatever you do, just don't go down that area. Because if you're wearing the wrong colours, you know, you'll be in trouble, just like you and Marcus were discussing the other night. And that was such a culture shock for me. It was so strange.
That kind of thing would have been just alien to me as well, growing up. You know, I grew up in West Lothian, Linlithgow. Yeah. Now, apparently, one of my commenters assures me that this divide does exist, even in West Lothian, but I never experienced it growing up. Somehow, it just wasn't there. I just wasn't aware of it. So, sorry I interrupted you.
No, it's fine. But that's as far as I can speak to the difference between the Highlands and the Lowlands. I personally, I don't hate cities, but being someone who prefers the peace and quiet, who prefers silence, I do like being up here. I'm not someone who needs to go places. I'm very much happy in this quiet little town. So, yeah, I don't have anything against the Lowlands and actually enjoy living in Glasgow, but I'd rather be where I am.
Before we go on any further, I forgot to ask you to introduce yourself to the audience and just describe yourself briefly, what you do and so on. I know that might be an insulting question to you, but
no, it's not.
I know that you are a very deep thinker and think everyone will already have perceived that. So I don't want to insult you, but if you could just introduce yourself to the audience.
Frankly, I'd be surprised if even one person in this chat knew who I was, but I am seeing some familiar faces there, and it's good to see you. But by introducing myself, I'm essentially introducing the subject, because there's nothing more uninteresting than the details of someone's personal life. So I'll just say that I speak on mysticism. I try to express mysticism, hopefully successfully at times. And so if it's okay with you, I'd like to get straight into what mysticism is and what it is not, because I feel there's a lot of confusion on this subject. Mysticism is not any kind of religion of itself or any kind of denomination. Rather, mysticism is at the heart. It is the essence of every tradition. Now, a mystic is one who, if you look up the term mystic, you see, for most people, the term mystic is completely interchangeable with that of magician, warlock, sorcerer, you know, these very generic terms that are used in different ways. For example, in the New Testament, condemns sorcery, but the word it uses for sorcery in, say, Revelation 21 is pharmakia, which actually refers to hallucinogens. So when passages like that in Revelation 21 condemn sorcery, they're actually condemning the use of hallucinogens. But other people use the word sorcery very differently. I use sorcery to refer to someone who manipulates another's psychology, for example. But mystic is not like generic terms like wizard, magician, sorcerer. Mystic has a very precise definition. Now, if you were to Google that definition, it would probably say something like, a mystic is one who seeks to achieve union with God, or something along those lines. But that, I feel, is an adequate definition, but not a very good definition. I think the superior definition would be that a mystic is one who strives to remember his unity with God, because no mystic ever proclaimed that they had attained unity with God. Rather, they proclaimed that they'd come to recognize how they had always had unity with God. And so, because mysticism is that which lies at the essence of each tradition, you will invariably have mystics arise from every different tradition and from no tradition at all. So, for example, some very famous Catholic mystics that have appeared in that tradition across history, you have figures like St. John of the Cross, St. Teresa of Avila. You've got Meister Eckhart in 13th century. In more modern history, you've got figures like Thomas Merton. And Islam, most famously, I would think, you've got the mystic Rumi, who's very famous for his poetry. But even in less what you might call mainstream traditions, you find these mystic figures arising. I'm sure many of you have heard of Eckhart Tolle, for example. He would be classed as a mystic, though he certainly wouldn't call himself that. And in fact, no true mystic would ever proclaim, "I am a mystic." That doesn't work that way.
Why not? Hold on a minute. That's a crucial thing. Why would a mystic not call himself a mystic?
Is it okay if I answer that later on? Because it's directly relevant to a key understanding.
Okay.
I will remember to come back to that. And if I don't chat, please remind me. And no, unfortunately, I can't be a druid. My affection for the Pictish people might make me like to be. But the reality is, you know, we've got to stick with historical reality. And the reality is that we know nearly nothing about what the druids actually believed. We know a few things from the Romans, but there's really not enough to start making doctrines and start forming collectives, although that doesn't stop anyone, you know. But no, all we can say with any degree of certainty about the Druids is that they almost certainly believed in reincarnation, but that's about it. So again, mysticism is the essence that lies at the heart of every different tradition. And this would include the pagan traditions. I know there are probably going to be several pagans in your audience. One issue with the pagan traditions is that because of the way that history played out, so much of what they believed has been lost. But there's no doubt, if you look at the sagas, that there were these figures that would arise that would be considered mystics, these strange hermits who would appear and disappear and so forth. Now, the comparison I like to use, actually I say I like to use it, I've just come up with it right now and I think it's a good one, it'll work for now anyway, is that let's say you have land and there is water beneath this land. And no, you can't take shrooms, at least not while I'm speaking. Maybe afterwards we'll talk about it later. So let's say there's water under this land and there's different wells on top of the land to get at this water. Those wells would be comparable to the different religious traditions of the world. And those wells, they have a different structure, they're different in form, and frankly, some are better than others. But the point of them all is to get to the water. Mystics are those who focus on getting to that water, whereas their religionist brethren are those who focus on the form of the well. They are concerned with the outward manifestation of their tradition rather than the essence that's at the heart of it. And this is why historically what you'll see is that religionists have actually been the worst enemies of mystics. Because religionists, and when I say religionist, I don't mean just anyone who adheres to a religion, because most religious souls, they are very, they're not overly concerned with their religion. It's not very serious to them. Religionists are those who are very focused on their dogmas, on their theologies, and so forth. They tend to be the worst enemies of the mystics for various reasons, which we may get into later on. But because of what I just explained, mystics will always have more in common with one another than they will even with their own religious brethren, because mystics get to that water, that spirit beneath the land, whereas the religionists are focused on fighting one another over the form of the well. And so it doesn't matter whether you're reading, say, a Hindu mystic like Ramana Maharshi or a Catholic mystic like St. John of the Cross, even though they come from completely different parts of the world and they come from different traditions and they certainly use different terminology, that's just a different expression. Anyone who's read these works can't fail to see the similarities. They are saying the same thing, and no true mystic has ever been dogmatic. No true mystic has ever been sectarian in the way that religionists often can be. And so because mysticism is this universal understanding, this universal truth, it is possible to express it in a variety of ways. If I'm speaking to someone in this town, you know, as you know, Scotland is a very secular country, and it's especially secular up here. So if I'm speaking to someone in this town, I use very straightforward language. I don't make references to sacred texts. But in this stream, I am going to do that because I know that a lot of your audience will resonate more with the Christian tradition. I also make references to paganism now and then. So it just depends who I'm speaking to. But the oldest source we have for mysticism would be the Upanishads, which are contained within the Hindu Vedas. These are the sacred texts within Hinduism. They're Sanskrit texts. The Upanishads, they above all texts, they lay what mysticism is about right there on the surface. Whereas a difficulty in the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, is that the mystic truth tends to be a bit more beneath the surface. But mysticism has pervaded culture in all kinds of ways. You all know the basic ideas of mysticism without knowing that you know them, simply because of the way it has pervaded pop culture. You know, just about any wise man, any hermit, or any wizard you see in historical fiction or outright fantasy, their dialogue, their way of thinking is almost certainly going to be informed by historical mystic thought. And there are so many examples of this one might cite. Even something like Rafiki from The Lion King. You ever seen The Lion King, Colin?
Actually, no, I haven't. I don't know how, but somehow I managed to avoid it in the 90s, and I managed to avoid the new one as well. Sorry.
Well, that's a brilliant film. It's well worth watching. But yeah, Rafiki and The Lion King. The Matrix as well has a lot of mystic ideas. And, you know, the most popular example, I would say, aside from maybe Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, obviously Gandalf, he is the archetypal mystic, essentially. But the more popular example in the modern day, I would suspect, is Star Wars. You know, you've got the Jedi and the Sith, and the idea of the Force. That is straight mysticism. It's just mysticism being conveyed in a science fiction context. Unfortunately, I'm not a Star Wars fan myself, so I can't really, you know, tell you where the comparisons are exactly. Everything I know about Star Wars comes from Red Letter Media. That's the best I can say.
Would you say that a mystic is somebody who tries to communicate directly with a religious experience instead of going through dogma?
Yes, and that is precisely what a large part of what I'm going to say tonight will be focused on. A mystic is about the direct experience. That is what they are about. If they're not concerned with direct experience, they're not a mystic. And if I could, I'd like to maybe explain something of my backstory to explain how I came to this place.
Certainly, please go ahead.
Well, as I said, I was born in a small town called Thurso in the far north of Scotland, and I wasn't raised within any religious tradition myself, which in some ways was a disadvantage because, you know, I didn't have that backdrop. I didn't have that head start, if you like, in understanding this subject. But on the other hand, it was a good thing because it meant I was free to explore however I would. And I was always very introverted. And so, you know, my mum would try and force me to go to these different social activities. So I joined the Scouts. I did fencing, as in sword fighting, not livestock containment, and all these different things, including Sunday school, which, of course, was no harsh theology test. It was just basically drawing pictures of Noah's Ark. Did you do anything like that, Colin, where you grew up? Was that ever a part of your childhood?
Yeah, only once. There was something called the Good News Club in Linlithgow one year, and I went to that for I think a few weeks. It was one of these summer things that kids would do during the summer holidays. So yes,
that sounds an awful lot like something we had called the Scripture Union, which I never took part in.
That was at my school. Scripture Union. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that, and I did go to it once. Yes. Yeah.
Well, I always had an interest in the big questions in life. Unlike everyone else in my family, you know, everyone in my family, they're very practical people. They're not opposed to spirituality, but at the same time, they're not interested in it. But I always was, and so from the earliest age, I would consume as much information as possible. And in hindsight, I can say that what I was doing was, even though I didn't know it at the time, I was hoping to stumble upon a piece of information in some ancient book or in some religion that would make sense of reality. That's what I was fundamentally doing. And so when I was a kid, you know, did you ever have, I don't know, the Mormons, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the Jehovah's Witnesses in your area at all?
No, no.
Well, the Mormons were particularly prevalent up here. And of course, this being a very secular area, you know, most people would just turn them away. But as a kid, I would invite them in. You know, my mum wasn't impressed by that. But I was very interested in
religion, and you were curious about it.
Yeah, exactly. And I just wanted to consume as much information as possible about it. Again, under the unconscious assumption that at some point I'd stumble upon some piece of information that would somehow make sense of everything. I didn't understand my motivations at that time. But there came a point and, well, yes, when I was 27 years old, I believe it was, when I got a good opportunity. Now, by this point, I had looked at just about every tradition there was. I had rejected Christianity in my teenage years for very superficial and facile reasons. The same reason I see a lot of people express contempt for Christianity in the modern day, which is simply that familiarity breeds contempt. To my childish mind, you know, Christianity, even though it was a Middle Eastern religion, it was very much the religion of the West. And I thought, I want something more exotic than that. And, you know, it's a very childish way to think, of course. And I see that a lot in those who are really opposed to the Christian message in the modern day. But I grew out of that, fortunately. And there came a point where I got the opportunity to become the marketing and media manager for a New Age fair, the organised fairs around Scotland. And I thought, well, this is perfect because the New Age arena is an arena I'd never had the opportunity to learn anything about. And so I thought, well, I could take this opportunity and, you know, I could do it as a full-time job, which is ultimately what I did. So I became this marketing and media manager in the hopes that maybe the New Age arena has something to offer. Now, every tradition has something to offer, ultimately. But what I found in the New Age arena is that people aren't very rigorous in the way that the way they structure their belief systems. They tend to just adopt beliefs that make them feel good. And I wanted something a bit more solid than that. And so I eventually grew disillusioned with it. And there came a point where I was in a particular relationship and this girl had already had two kids, so I was busy with them. And I just felt myself settling down into a normal life. I had a nice job, nice relationship. And so these questions, the intense drive that I'd felt before, it gradually seemed to die down until the event in June of 2012, when I walked into the office one day. I put the kettle on. I was always the first into the office. I put the kettle on, and I sat down waiting for my computer to boot up. And I remember I was sitting there thinking about the power of prayer. And that was nothing unusual for me, because I like to think of these things. You know, I contemplated these things a lot. And the silly dilemma I know is silly in hindsight, I was thinking of that morning was, what would happen, right? Let's say, Colin, you and I are both worthy of having our prayers answered by God, okay? So you make a prayer and I make a prayer, but these prayers would contradict one another in the world. You know, how would God respond to that? In hindsight, I can see that it's a silly question because it misunderstands the nature of prayer, but at the time I took it seriously. So I was sitting there contemplating this question, and all at once I felt, I can only describe it as feeling the presence of God all around me. It was like the presence of God permeated everything around me. When I moved my arm through the air, for example, I knew I was moving it through the being of God. And the love and the peace I felt was just indescribable. But it wasn't as if I felt that God had just manifested. I knew that God was actually always there in the way that I was now experiencing him, but that we're just oblivious to that fact. So this lasted for about a few minutes in total, but the residual effects lasted for about a week afterwards, and that just blew my mind. And I know how people respond to this because I've shared this story enough times. I've got a broken arm, I've got a broken nose, no feeling on the back of my left hand, but psychologically, no, I have no issues whatsoever. I do not do drugs or even drink alcohol. You don't drink alcohol either, do you, Colin?
No, I don't.
No, what's your reason for it? Because personally, I just don't like being out of my normal state, you know?
Well, my reason is just that I had epilepsy as an adolescent. So the doctors told me, don't get drunk because you'll be more likely to have a fit. So I never drank, and so I never developed a taste for alcohol or a tolerance for it. And so it ended up being a vice that I just avoided by mistake. There we go. That's it.
You're really not missing anything at all. Because in my teenage years, I used to drink, and it's just a waste of money, in my opinion. But I had that experience, what people might call a transcendent experience. And so that it seemed strange to me at the time, because I'd spent all these years looking for an answer, you know, and then I'd settled into regular life, and now suddenly I have this experience. And the strangest thing for me at the time was that I was left with the distinct impression that the person known as Jesus Christ was somehow responsible for that experience. And I couldn't account for that, because I'd never resonated with the Christian tradition. I tried reading the Bible in my teenage years, and it just seemed like nonsense to me. And so this experience happened, and I was left with nowhere to go. So what's someone supposed to do? I went and read the Bible again. It was like reading a whole new book. And eventually I became a Baptist, a regular Christian for a while. And that led me to where I am in the modern day. But that's just the backstory that's necessary to give you a context, because whenever you speak on these subjects, the people you're speaking to, they make certain assumptions. And many of those assumptions simply aren't true in my case. So in order to go further into mysticism, I'd like to try something out, Colin, if you don't mind. You see, when I do live streams, I just articulate my understanding as, so this experience made him want to have long hair. No, not bothering about my appearance made me have long hair. There was no want about it. When I'm doing live streams by myself, you know, I just articulate my understanding as well as I can. But it's very different when you're speaking to someone in the real world, because the connection is more personal and it's more intimate, naturally. And so since this is a conversation between myself and you, I'd like to add a little twist to this millennial, if you'll agree to it, whereby I ask you the questions in order to illustrate what I've got to say. Would you be up for that? And they are not hard questions.
Yeah, all right.
Okay.
I don't know. It depends what this will consist of, but
don't worry. These are very simple questions. This is you'll enjoy this, I should think. So what I would say to those watching is that you're going to be watching for all kinds of reasons. Millennials make very good listening material. Many of you will be playing video games, listening to them in the background. I realize that. But if you are someone who is struggling right now, you know, suffering due to the lockdown or anything else that's going on in your life, I would recommend that you listen closely to what is about to be expressed. And even if you're just someone who has an interest in spirituality broadly, I think that this will be of interest to you. So, Colin, you're someone who has far more of a focus on politics than I do. I'm going to make a statement, and I'd appreciate if you could give me your feedback on that statement. It's been my observation that the left, and we're speaking generally here, the left seem to assume malevolence on the part of the right. And so if the right disagree with something, then as far as the left are concerned, it can only be for selfish or malevolent reasons. Let's take the issue of free healthcare. From the perspective of many leftists, it seems like a no-brainer. Well, what person would not want to give so many other people free healthcare? Whereas someone on the right might point out, well, look, it's not truly free. Someone has to pay for it somewhere. And the question is, that then becomes a more nuanced question of should we be paying for other people's healthcare? But the left don't tend to see that nuance, and therefore they ascribe malevolence where there is none. Do you think that is a fair summary of what so often happens?
Yes.
So you are not someone who would be opposed to a peaceful world, a utopia where we all live side by side. It's just that you recognize certain realities that mean that is not possible in the way that the left thinks is possible. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to explain four things that's very important to understand. The first thing is that most souls approach knowledge in completely the wrong fashion. And you have probably had some experience of this, Colin. I'm sure I've heard you express this frustration before, where people will immediately, and this is natural, of course, but when someone hears another person speak, they will immediately assign them to a category. And based on the category they've assigned them to, they've already decided how closely they're going to listen to them, if at all. Have you had that experience, Colin?
Yes, it's something that I became aware of as I got older, and then tried to hold at bay, because you realize, you know, experience teaches you that you might miss out on something if you have a dismissive attitude off the bat to someone.
Yes, exactly, and yet most souls do this. In your stream with Marcus, you mentioned the narcissism of small differences at one point. And this is a very important, it's a very interesting phenomenon, I find it personally. The narcissism of small differences, and maybe Colin could explain it better, but essentially it means that, say you have two souls, they are two souls who believe similar things. They are more likely to argue with one another and to have a problem with one another than they are with someone who believes something radically different. You know, so two Christians are more likely to have fiery debates with one another than they are with a Buddhist. Perhaps because the Buddhist worldview is so seemingly different from the Christian worldview. Would you think that's a fair explanation of that phenomenon?
Yes, I think that people get more annoyed and animated by small disagreements than by major ones, because with major ones it's, I don't know, I guess in normal civic life, there's no point even wrangling with someone with a major disagreement, because you can't do anything about it. Whereas with a small disagreement, it's much more in focus. I think that this definitely happens all the time.
Absolutely. And so when I come on here and I'm using terminology that many of you are familiar with, but my understanding of it is slightly different, or even something as simple as I use different terms, it's more likely to inflame, like if I'm referencing Christian terminology, it's more likely to cause a problem with the Christians who who are listening, because they use the same terminology but understand it in different ways. So, for example, I like to, you know, I call Jesus Christ Yeshua because that's his original Hebrew name. And the number of Christians I encounter who don't know this is quite extraordinary. But quite simply, the name of Yeshua, as it's contained within the Koine Greek of the New Testament, is Jesus. In Latin, that is Isis. Now, the letter J that we have in the modern English language, it didn't come about until the medieval period. And it came about by people putting a tail on the I, and therefore Isis becomes Jesus. That's how we get the name of Jesus. But the name of the man we know as Jesus was almost certainly either Yeshua or Yehoshua. I say Yeshua. So there's an example of a small difference that is historically accurate, but people would have a problem with that. The reason I use the name of Yeshua is that, well, if you use the name Jesus with people, because so much has been done in the name of Jesus, people immediately are closed off to whatever you have to say because they think, oh, this is about Jesus. I don't want to know about everything associated with him. Whereas the name of Yeshua is fresh to souls, and therefore they're more open to what you have to say. Justin Lee in the chat says, Jesus isn't Isis, Zeitgeist was debunked. Yeah, I don't agree with Zeitgeist at all. I understand that. So it's important that we ignore, that we're willing to listen to anyone regardless of what category we would put them in. The other thing is, and I think Colin knows this, the fact that I have a different focus from most of you watching this doesn't mean I dispute or I'm against anything you have to say. You know, Colin and I could have a discussion on nationalistic issues, and I'm quite sure we'd agree in many areas. You know, if someone wants to say that, well, look, if you ask someone, do you have preference for your own family over other families, they would, of course, say yes. And then you could point out that your town and, you know, your nation is just an extension of your family, and therefore it makes sense to have a preference for them. That's just logical. Just because I don't focus on that kind of thing doesn't mean I disagree with your points. So often, just because I don't have a focus on certain things, people assume that I'm opposed to what they're saying when I'm not. It's simply not my focus. The third and most important thing to understand of all these four points is that spirituality is not an intellectual project. And you said it yourself earlier, Colin, when you said that mystics are about direct experience. That's right, because spirituality is experiential. You can read as much as you want about Colin, and you can speculate as much as you want about Colin, but until you speak to Colin, in other words, until you have an experience of Colin, you don't really know Colin. And nowhere is that more true than of the spirit. And there are several consequences of thinking that spirituality is an intellectual endeavor. It's the reason you have a world full of souls who profess a form of spirituality, but their spirituality just comes down to a theology or a system of beliefs or a system of ideas. The problem with that, aside from the fact that mere theologies and mere ideas, they are of the mind and they can't bestow you with any power, is the fact that you essentially turn those who excel in spirituality to an intellectual elite, which you know in your hearts, you know intuitively, can't be true. I mean, if you attend church, just think about the little old lady that sits down to you in church. Does she have any hope of sitting there listening to 2 hours of your favorite theologian or your favorite apologist? No, of course not. She doesn't have the cognitive capacity to wrestle with that. But if you make spirituality an intellectual project, what you essentially do is shut the likes of her out of the kingdom of heaven, to use Christian terminology. And you know in your heart there is something deeply wrong with that. Because spirituality is not a matter of intellect. It's a matter of purity of heart, which is sincerity or honesty of intention. That's just simply how it is. And so the honest truth is, and many people aren't going to like this, but if your spirituality consists entirely of theologies or belief systems, no matter how convoluted they are, then you have no spirituality at all, because spirituality is about direct experience. And because it's about direct experience, you don't need dogmas, you don't need doctrines at all. And the final point before I begin to ask Colin certain questions is...
Just before you go on, that reminded me, what you just said reminded me of a quote. The letter killeth...
The spirit gives life, the apostle Paul, yes.
Yes. Yeah, isn't... Yeah.
I love that. I was actually... I inevitably end up getting there. So, the fourth thing is that, you know, sometimes the higher understandings aren't necessarily appropriate. Let's say you have a mathematician. A mathematician knows far more than a high school teacher who happens to teach mathematics, right? I know this because I know many high school teachers. And let's just say, you know, when I was a kid in high school, looking up to these as if they were really special beings, well, I now know very differently. But the understanding of a mathematician is obviously superior to that of a teacher who teaches maths. And yet, that greater understanding of the mathematician is clearly superfluous to requirements when it comes to the high school students, because they are not in a place where they can make use of his superior understanding. And therefore, for those high school students, the understanding of the math teacher is more than adequate. And the reason I'm saying this is because one thing that distinguishes those who bestow mystic teachings from religionists is that so many religionists are dogmatic and insist that other people be where they are and see things the way that they see things, whereas mystics understand that that can't be the case because the world is finely balanced. Everyone is where they are meant to be. I like to climb. I like to free climb. And if I was to fall from a cliff one day and break my back on the rocks below, it definitely wouldn't be a team of mystics that were coming to airlift me to safety. Now, the world has to have this balance to it. And so just because I'm bestowing understandings here, I don't have any expectation at all that everyone watching is going to or even should accept them. It just depends where you are in your own development. So that's very important to understand, because it's understandable that if you're speaking to other souls on spiritual matters, they assume that you want them to believe what you believe, but that's not true in the case of mystic teachings. Now, Colin, have you ever worked in a call center?
Yes, for 1 week. I got fired.
I would be amazed if you had said no, being Scottish. So you were there.
Oh, yeah. It was actually in London, though, I've got to say.
Oh,
yeah,
okay. That's surprising.
Yeah.
So you were there for a week, and was that past your trial period?
Oh, yeah, I was 22, something like that.
So did you ever have to do team building?
Yes, we did icebreakers. Yeah, I can't remember what it was now.
Oh, but
yeah,
that's the worst thing.
I think that was a thing in the mid-2000s. I think that kind of stuff was fashionable then. I don't know if it's still so fashionable now. I'm not sure.
I know it still goes on, but to be honest, that's what people dread most about call centers. You know, Marcus, I don't know if you've watched his really old videos, but he made a video about working in call centers, and he talks about these training exercises. But one thing that they'll do in these team building exercises is that they'll make you stand up and, you know, they'll say, okay, Colin, why don't you tell everyone here something about yourself? Have you ever had to do that?
Yes, I had to tell one thing that was true and one thing that was a lie, and then everyone else had to guess which was which.
So if someone said now, okay, Colin, tell, you're in a group of people, and they said to you, okay, Colin, tell us all something about yourself, how would you respond?
Well, it would depend on the context. I don't know. I'd go for something completely benign, like I like raspberry smoothies. Something like that. No one could possibly object to.
Right. You see, our egoic identity, you know, that's the idea we have of who we are. But the truth is that only we know the intricacies of our egoic identity. We certainly don't project it out on the world at every opportunity. In different contexts, we share what we think is appropriate. Even in very simple ways, you don't speak to your best friend in the same way that you speak to your parents, for example. That's just a given. And so we always speak in half-truths about ourselves, essentially. And the reality is that all suffering comes from an attachment to this egoic identity. You know, Colin himself has talked about the enormous pressure he's felt to make videos in the past because, you know, that's how he sees himself. And seeing himself in a certain way as someone who makes videos, he feels he has an obligation to his audience. Now, when we speak about this lockdown, is this something that has affected you in not a practical way, but a psychological way, say? Have you felt down or repressed about this lockdown at all?
You'd probably be better asking somebody else that question, because I had other things to deal with this year. So the lockdown was kind of trivial to me, and I mean, it did annoy me that, you know, we can't. I remember at the start, I was annoyed that we can't go. I developed a sort of fixation with going to a restaurant because I realized I can't go to a restaurant, and that annoyed me. And so for a week or two, I was thinking, God, it'd be really nice to go to a restaurant, have a meal, you know. But I hardly ever go to restaurants. So that was it was just because I knew I couldn't do it that it annoyed me. But really, I'm, you know, as you might expect, I spend a lot of my time indoors anyway. So the lockdown really wasn't much of a change for me. So I am an unusual case for all of these reasons. So you'd be better asking somebody else about whether the lockdown got them down. It didn't get me down. To be honest, psychologically, I've actually been a lot better this year than you would expect.
you brought up a phenomenon there that is very common, and it's directly relevant to what I just said, which is that, you know, you said, and like me, you're not one who goes out much anyway. But suddenly, when someone says that you can't go out, suddenly it's a problem. And it goes back to this egoic identity, because you understand yourself as someone who at least has the freedom to do certain things, even if you don't make use of them. And when someone tells you that you can't do those things, you feel restricted, even though you never made use of those liberties in the first place. And that's a crystal clear example. And you said sorry to me and said I should ask someone else, but actually you made the point I was about to make for me by saying that you never made use of these freedoms, but you still felt their loss. Okay, those of you in the chat, what's your favourite film? And you'll get bonus points if you give the correct answers of Highlander or Conan the Barbarian. Now, Colin, maybe I'm misremembering, but did you not once say that your favourite film of the Alien franchise is Alien 3?
Yes.
Yeah.
This is weird. You know things about me. I didn't know how much you watched my...
Oh, no, don't worry. That.
My favourite film is from the Alien thing, quadrilogy is Alien 3, yeah, for sure.
What about your... Got a favourite colour?
Purple.
Purple, I agree. What about a lucky number, or favourite number?
Seven.
Seven, okay, interesting. Mystic number. I'm looking at the answers in the chat. I knew one of you would say Triumph of the Will. You knew that. I knew one of you would say that. I just knew it. Even as a joke, I knew one of you would say it. But I agree with you about Alien 3, because Ridley Scott would be the first one to say that Alien was just a well-made B-movie. James Cameron
exactly.
would be...
It's a horror... Yeah.
James Cameron would be the first one to say that Aliens was just a well-made action movie. Alien 3 was the first one in the series, I feel, that really tried to have proper themes, you know, redemption, sacrifice...
Exactly. Those are the two themes that I would have mentioned as well. Redemption and especially sacrifice and nihilism, the threat of that life is meaningless. And someone said Alien 3 over Alien. What WTF? Alien is the better film. technically speaking. Yep. In all technical terms, Alien is better, superior to Alien 3. But Alien 3 is a more deep and, for me, interesting film. It's also a more aesthetically cool film for me. I love the music, the sets, the costumes, everything. So,
have you seen the assembly cut?
Yes. It is better. It clearly is. But, I mean, there's more of Paul McGann's character for a start, and who could say no to that? Yeah, he's
great. I do feel that I prefer the alien coming out of a dog than an ox, because I think it's more dog-like.
Yes.
And I prefer the shot of Ripley falling into the lava in the theatrical cut than I do in the assembly cut, because it looks very animated.
You really know this well, don't you? I agree. Did they not do some kind of CGI thing with one of the versions where it's not actually from 1992, it's actually from...
Yeah, that was the assembly cut, that's why.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, personally, Jean-Pierre Genet's Alien Resurrection, I can do without. I literally prefer Alien vs. Predator over Alien Resurrection. How do you feel?
I haven't seen either of the Alien vs. Predator films.
Oh.
So I don't know. And I just had a bad feeling about them. As for Alien Resurrection, I think it's actually... It's not a good Alien film, but it is actually quite a good film in its own right. It's quite a scary horror. It's quite an effective horror film in its own right. But it doesn't fit into the previous three films. It's too different. It's too French, honestly, in a word. It doesn't feel that the first three films feel like sort of Anglosphere despair in various ways, because they're all English director, Canadian director, and then American director. But the fourth one it just feels very French in its mentality and its aesthetics and so on.
And I feel it just renders Ripley's sacrifice at the end of the third film meaningless. I mean, I know it's a clone in the fourth one, but I just think it ruins that ending personally.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Chat, what's your favourite food? And Colin, what's your favourite food?
This is quite unadventurous, but I really like baked potatoes.
Really?
I wish I could give you something more elaborate.
For me, baked potatoes are the last resort.
I do like that. I like pizzas, but not quite as much. There you go.
How do you feel about scampi and tartar sauce?
No, not for me. No, sorry. But I would imagine that is quite a popular dish in the Highlands with all the harbour.
If you can afford it, but I've worked out that if you get fish fingers and salad cream, if you close your eyes, you can just about imagine that it's scampi and tartar sauce. Now, Colin, you know more about music than I do, far more. I listen to mostly David Bowie and Enya, but I would like you to confirm something for me, if possible. Am I right in thinking that Cotton Eye Joe is the worst song ever created?
Rednecks. Well, you know, I bought the single back in the day.
Really?
Buy the CD single, yeah. It's pretty cheap mid-90s dance pop. It's very disposable, yes.
They played it so much in my high school that I took an instant disliking to it. Everyone did that at the Battle of the Bands. It was... Now, do you remember, you're obviously, nationalism to you, very important to who you are and who you became across the years. Do you remember when you first came across that as an ideal or as an idea in your life?
Well, I've told this story many times. It started when I moved to London when I was 19, and I realized that there was a lot of distance between the different ethnic groups, both in my student community and in London at large. I realized that different ethnic groups simply didn't seem to mix very much and didn't seem to like each other or enjoy each other's presence. And I also noticed that conversation between people of different backgrounds was very shallow because they didn't have anything in common, any deep sort of cultural reference points or anything. So everything was clumsy because of the language barrier, but also shallow. So... Yeah, that was what made me. And also there was just this underlying tension, not in the student community so much, but in the place where I was living, the area of London where I was living, it just seemed like no one's really happy with this situation here. That's how it seemed to me. So that was the start. That's when I was 19. And over the years, I learned about things more. And I just came to think, I came to the conclusion that multiculturalism is a mistake. And it would be better if people lived in their own areas. And I think that most people would prefer that. And even the immigrants to the West, I think that most of them would prefer if we weren't around, if they could live in their own place, or they could live without us. And that's not to say that...
I need to get you in trouble by asking you this.
I don't think that... I'm not saying that I think they hate us. I don't think they are going to... You're talking about dozens of different ethnic groups anyway, so that I wouldn't want to give a blanket statement about them. But I just think that, well, to rely on a sort of catchphrase, but diversity plus proximity equals conflict, or at least the potential, the ever-present potential for conflict.
At various points in their lives, people might say that, you know, I am finally able to be me. In the modern day, you see this when, you know, someone comes out as homosexual or what have you. They come to a point where they say, I'm finally able to be me. What they've undergone has been a defining moment as far as their experience is concerned. Would you say that either encountering nationalism or becoming a nationalist yourself was such a defining moment for you, that in a way you look back on the person you were before that and you can't recognize them, or you wouldn't want to recognize them in some ways?
There was never a moment when I said I wasn't a nationalist yesterday and now today I am, or that I signed a dotted line or something like that. So it was never that definitive. And I don't know if I'm changing history here or misremembering my own history. I have described myself as a nationalist, but it's not something that I would... I'm a human being. I'm a British guy. Those are indisputable facts. But to say I'm a nationalist is less clear cut. And it's not because I'm going back on it or whatever. I just don't... I'm not as attached to it as you seem to think I am. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just see it as an obvious, rational, logical choice for people to live in their own areas, in the same way that families have... Each family has its own house. It's just a sane thing. Each person in the house ideally has their own room in the house. And this just seems not natural to me. But I don't see nationalist as an identity, right? So it's not like, this is what I am. So that's what I think is, I think you might be a bit mistaken about that, that I sort of attach myself steadfastly to that label.
Oh, no, it was just an open question. I just wanted to see how you'd respond to that. But you would say it's certainly a part of your egoic identity. I mean, it's part of how you understand yourself naturally.
Yeah.
Some might see it as a bigger part than it actually is.
Yeah, exactly. To me, it's just common sense. Understand why. I mean, I can understand people enjoying multiculturalism, enjoying going to the city and oh, there's so much here, so many novelties. How exciting. I can understand somebody having and going through that phase, but I think that most people want predictability. So it just seems like common sense. I mean, imagine if, you know, in the Highlands it was suddenly, you know, Buddhists and Chinese people and Muslims and Africans and voodoo Jamaicans or whatever, Caribbeans. That would be suddenly very confusing for you. Whereas if it's the culture that you are familiar with and that you've always known, then you know what the situation is. So right. That's what I would say about that.
How do you understand reincarnation?
That's a change of topic, isn't it? I don't understand reincarnation at all. I don't have any
understanding. But how do you understand... What do you understand the concept to be referring to? What do you think the basic idea is?
There is a thing called the soul which outlives the biology which temporarily hosts it and finds a new biology to host it upon death.
Right. That is the what you might call the exoteric understanding of reincarnation. If you ask someone what reincarnation is, that's what they'll typically answer. But when it comes to every different tradition in the world, there is the exoteric understanding, which is to say the surface level understanding, and the esoteric understanding. The esoteric understanding of reincarnation is not that it refers to a cycle of physical death and rebirth, but that it refers to the very cycle of personhood we've just been discussing, the way that we throughout our mortal lives change. Now, as you just said yourself, for reincarnation to be possible, there must be that, namely a soul, to go from one mortal form to another. And so therefore, when it comes to the esoteric understanding of reincarnation, the question becomes, what is that perceives these changes in personhood? And so this is where we come on to the main point here. And incidentally, the esoteric understanding does not negate the exoteric understanding. They could both be true, but it's not really relevant right now. But some of you will be familiar with the tarot. One of your guests mentioned working with the tarot. I've watched a lot of your millennials. I've thoroughly enjoyed them. Many interesting things have been said. The death card in the tarot, even though it's used in a very dramatic fashion in Hollywood films, you know, to show that a character's about to die or what have you, actually, it refers to the kind of death we've just been talking about. A significant change in personhood where you understand yourself in a drastically different way, so that you could regard yourself as a different person entirely. Therefore, you know, when you speak to someone and you ask them about something they did in the past, they'll say, well, I was a completely different person then. Now, just as you said, there must be that within, for exoteric reincarnation to be true, there must be a soul to incarnate into different mortal forms. So too must there be that which is constant or persistent, something that persists between this fluctuating personhood, where at many points even we don't know who we are exactly. Now,
it's an interesting idea, because I always find it very difficult to remember when someone asks, like, what was I like at 21 or 17? How did I differ at 25? And so I can remember specific things that happened. And I can remember feeling specific emotions here and there, but I can't say how the totality of me at 17 differed from the totality of me at 22 or whatever. Mm-hmm. Very, very difficult to say that.
So there's a statement in the Gospel of Thomas, which is a Gnostic text. They call it a Gnostic text. Now, I know the Bible inside out. I make a point of studying the different sacred texts of the world so that I can be informed when I'm speaking to different people who may come from different traditions or appeal to them in different ways. Now, this particular saying is saying 18 of the Gospel of Thomas, and the disciples run up to Yeshua, they run up to Jesus, and they say, tell us what our end will be. And this is very typical for souls in this world. They always have their attention focused on either the past or the future, very rarely on where they are at the current time. So the disciples ask Yeshua, Lord, tell us what our end will be. And Yeshua's response to them is, Have you discovered the beginning that you search for the end? For where the beginning is, there the end shall be. Blessed is he who shall take his place in the beginning. He shall know the end, and he shall not taste death. Now, a great problem for us in the modern day is that we're so far removed from the authors of these sacred texts that we really have little idea of what they were referring to when they said certain things. And so to us, thanks in a large part to Hollywood and the way that certain things are portrayed to us, we imagine that they're referring to really abstract things. But the beginning that Yeshua is referring to there, when the disciples ask him about the end, and he says, have you discovered the beginning that you look for the end? For where the beginning is, there the end shall be. That is nothing other than consciousness. And it's consciousness that witnesses the fluctuations of personhood. This is what the ancients called spirit. Consciousness is spirit. You say spirit to someone now, and because of Hollywood, you know, they're thinking of Patrick Swayze and Ghost. That's what they're thinking. They're thinking of like a phantom in front of them. But when the ancients used the term spirit, they simply meant consciousness. There's nothing, there's no belief required there because we are all consciousness. And so we as souls are portions of consciousness, portions of this great consciousness that men have called God, living out an experience of individuality. And so this resolves so many different issues. You'll often see atheists say, for example, you know, if someone thanks God that someone made it through a surgery, an atheist can often come along and say that, well, why are you thanking God? You know, it's the doctors that saved the person's life. But rightly understood, you know, those doctors themselves are souls, portions of this great spirit we call God, and we understand that as consciousness. Now, the Islamic mystic Rumi, he has a very famous quote, and he was talking about where his spiritual journey had led him. He said, "I was knocking on a door, but I came to see that I'd been knocking from the inside." You see, like everyone who starts out on their search for God, they're always looking out into the external world, even if it's into another spiritual dimension. But what Rumi came to realize is that while he was looking for God out there somewhere, as most souls innately start to do, he realized that he, as he said, was knocking from the inside, because as consciousness, he was a soul and therefore eternally united with this great being that we call God. This is the recognition of the mystic. And you see, there's no system. You don't have to buy into anything to understand this. You don't have to buy into any complicated theology or any dogma at all. It's self-evident that you are consciousness and that personhood develops and plays out in the ways that we've gone through. That's the reason I asked you all these questions about, you know, Alien 3 and all these things. I just, the first thing came to my head, you know, when I was asking those questions. And so what happens is that through life, we go through a process of conditioning, quite simply. You know, a child doesn't conceive of things in the way that we do as an adult. If you've ever had any experience around children, they are just perceiving everything and they're sort of gazing around in wonder, just accepting things as it comes. And of course, a child has a guardian, and that guardian gives that child a certain name, but the child doesn't have the cognitive capacity to receive that name as anything other than a series of sounds. But as its cognitive capacity develops, it begins to recognize that this name is the name by which it is identified among other souls, and therefore it comes to recognize itself as having a name. And that is the foundation of the egoic identity that we've been talking about thus far. And as it gets older, it begins to recognize itself as human as opposed to not, as male as opposed to female, as straight as opposed to gay, and so on, until in adulthood, this consciousness has had a lot of conditioning heaped upon it. And as I said earlier, its egoic identity is so complex that it can only be known fully by it. But speaking experientially, what happens is that the consciousness becomes confined by this egoic identity, and it suffers as a result of that identification in the ways that we talked about earlier. You understand yourself as being a certain thing in the world and having a certain responsibility in the world, and therefore, if conditions in the world don't allow you to meet those requirements, you suffer as a consequence. That's what happens with conditioning ultimately. But we must all lose this egoic identity. You know, our bodies and our minds will leave eventually. You know, they will all fade away. Sometimes even before the death of our mortal form. My grandfather died 2 years ago and he suffered from dementia near the end, and I had to look after him an awful lot. Now, my grandfather, when I was growing up, he was a real militaristic type. So he was always telling me to straighten my back, polish my shoes, get my hair cut. Then, as you can see, he failed in at least one of those things. But he was always this really strong militaristic type. But with his dementia, his egoic identity, as it were, completely gone. He didn't know who he was, didn't know who I was, didn't know anything. He just didn't know anything at all. And it occurred to me, even as I was, you know, with him at that time, that he was very much like a child again, just passively taking in anything that came. But this period, before conditioning has begun, before an egoic identity begins to develop, this period is what we call innocence. And it's a very common theme in religious literature, for example. And it's a state that all mystics, you know, aspire to return to. And so, for example, Yeshua said to his disciples, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Yeshua consistently used children as examples of what his disciples should be, and it's because of their innocence. Have you got a pet now, Colin, or have you ever had a pet at all?
No, I haven't. I'd like to have one, but no, I don't.
Well, you can tell me in the chat if you guys have pets, and if you've ever had the experience of feeling more grief over the death of a pet than even someone, a human being that was close to you. Maybe someone in your family or something like that. You see, the innocence that children have before they gain the capacity to contemplate themselves, it's the same innocence that animals always have, because animals, unlike human beings, they never obtain the capacity to contemplate their own existence in the same way that human beings do. And therefore, even though I've seen people in this community do it, you might criticize someone for being more upset over the death of an animal than they are for a human being. It actually makes sense, because an animal is always an innocent, because it doesn't understand itself, much less its place in the larger world. This whole idea of innocence is very important to understand. Now, the whole point of spirituality, or any spirituality, is to undo the conditioning that we went through throughout the course of our mortal life to return to this place of innocence. It's what Yeshua talks about over and over again. And so, because we were conditioned into the egoic identity that we currently have, it usually takes a process of conditioning to get us out of it. At other times, it can happen instantly. And when it happens instantly, that's when you have what's called a major transcendent experience. But I remember myself, when I was going through this process of unconditioning, as it were, I would have a recurring dream that I was drowning, that David McMurdo was drowning, because you identify as your egoic identity. And therefore, if you try to detach from that egoic identity, it feels like a form of death in a sense. And so that's how it manifested in my life. But then I persisted and got over it. And so the point is that for anyone who's suffering out there, you know, you don't have to go all the way with this. But for anyone who's suffering out there, you have to put what you take to be yourself aside. You have to remove your own idea of yourself, because it's only your own idea of who you are that can suffer in the end. And so the mystics have always understood the value of silence. Silence is a very powerful thing. The 13th century Catholic mystic, Meister Eckhart, he once said that there is nothing so like God in all of creation as silence. And the reason is because silence is the most subtle thing, like God. And this is why, by the way, contemplative practices are typically done in silence, because it's conductive to reaching that inner space, that spirit, that consciousness that we were discussing earlier. The reality is that, you know, you don't have to identify as anything at all. You can just dismiss that thought. You simply defer to silence in any matter. And that's how you return to that experience of yourself as pure consciousness, because it's your investment in your egoic identity that causes this feeling of constriction, and therefore leaves you vulnerable to other things in the world or your ideas of how things should be. But there's no need for that. You can simply dismiss that idea of yourself, because as consciousness, you necessarily transcend both the material realm and the mental realm, and therefore there is no reason for you to be adversely affected by phenomena in either of those realms. The reason you are is because you identify as egoic identity that is in the mind, and therefore you're susceptible to the things of the mind. And so that's simply, you know, I could go into this in more depth, but I can see it's 9:30 already. I had intended to go into more depth, but it's 9:30, so I don't know.
I would ask you a few questions.
Yes, please do. That'd be a good idea.
It seems to me that when one is young, it's easy to be, and most young people are, insecure and self-obsessed, paranoid. I certainly was very insecure as a teenager and early 20s. I don't know. I think that started to wear off in my late 20s. And I think it's because you're young, you're fragile, you're brittle. You don't know how strong you are, so there, you think there's a lot to fear from being hurt by other people or being judged by other people. And you could say it's young ego, especially young male ego. Would you say that dissipating as you get older is a version of what you're talking about?
Right. It's important for me to say that there is no such thing as accidents. You know, the fact that we were conditioned into having an egoic identity and that it leaves us feeling vulnerable to existence, that's the way it was meant to be. And as I said earlier, not everyone is ready to go all the way with reversing that process, because the simple fact is that many people enjoy this world. Many people enjoy their life in this world. They wake up with a spring in their step and they just can't wait to get on with their day. This process is for the one who has become weary with the world. And typically it's suffering that makes one weary with the world. It's suffering that causes what you might describe as a fracture in one's egoic identity. This is why transcendent experiences so often occur at a point of tragedy in a person's life, because their egoic identity has been fractured. And so, yes, I would say that it is a natural thing, because the longer you are alive, the more you experience, and the more you both grow weary of experience, and the more suffering you will invariably come across or endure. And that is the value of suffering in itself.
Yes. Okay. Several other questions that are not connected to this narrative, but occurred to me while you were talking. They're connected to other parts of what you were saying. Is a mystic the same thing as a shaman?
These terms can be used in different ways. I've heard of shaman being used in that way many times, yes.
All right. I thought so. It sounded like, I know a shaman or shaman I associate more with the use of psychedelic drugs, psychoactive substances, but I know that that's not necessarily part of it.
Yeah, that's how most people would associate it as well. Now, personally, I don't mind. You know, people can do what they want with their own lives. All I would say is, do you really want your spirituality to be dependent upon substances? Would it not be more powerful if your spirituality was something that was innate to you, as it actually is anyway? If you have to have substances to feel at peace, then that doesn't speak well. Now, like someone in the chat says, being quote-unquote spiritual is the biggest ego trip, and I'm glad he said that, because it reminded me of your earlier question that I was going to respond to. Why I don't call myself a mystic. It's because the whole idea is to overcome your egoic identity, or to detach from your egoic identity. And if you give yourself a title like mystic, then, well, that's rather grandiose. So that can only serve to inflate the very thing you're trying to overcome. So it's best to defer to silence, as I just said. And no, I don't consider myself in any way at all. I simply am what I am, and I do what I do. So that's why no true mystic would go around calling themselves a mystic.
I think there's a sort of equivalent of that is when people refer to me as a thought leader, thought as in thought, just for the sake of clarity. And I have been referred to as a thought leader, and it's like, all right, I guess I am one, but it's happened by accident. Like, I never set out to be one. And I think, because you'd have to be pretty vain to say, to think, okay, I'm going to become a thought leader.
Well, precisely.
I mean, really.
And a problem is as well, Colin, as you'll know, is that you have to, at certain points, you have to describe yourself as something. If you're going to introduce yourself to anyone, you have to describe yourself as something. Now, I'm positive you wouldn't describe yourself as a thought leader. You wouldn't say, hello, I'm Colin the thought leader.
I lead. You know? I mean, that's just, no, I wouldn't say that.
Exactly. So we need to use terms, but especially given that the point of spirituality is to overcome the egoic identity, I'm not about to bestow myself with such a grandiose term because that would be counter to the point.
Okay, that makes sense. Given what I've said, I can understand fully now why you don't call yourself a mystic. That makes perfect sense to me. I wish I'd asked you some very basic, rudimentary questions at the start just to get a grounding. Are you a Christian?
No. As I said, no, because there's no reason to confine yourself to a tradition. I don't care who's listening to this video. I don't care whether they consider themselves a Christian, a Muslim, a Hindu, a communist, you know, some leftist hate-watching Colin. I don't care who you are. You can make use of the understanding, the simple fact that you are consciousness, and that all you need is to return to the awareness of the fact that you are consciousness, this thing that in the ancient world they called spirit. It's as simple as that. There is no more needed than that. And the way you do that is to detach from your egoic identity by ceasing to identify as it. It's really that simple. It's all anyone ever needs. And look, there are plenty of people in this world who will say that you need their beliefs, you need to belong to their collective, but they're looking for something from you. I'm not here to get likes for or follows for my Twitter account or subscriptions for a YouTube channel that I'm barely on because I'm barely on the internet. It's just too much noise for me. I'm not here to get the approval of anyone in chat. I'm here to simply state the truth. And whether people watching make use of that or not is down to them. But I get nothing from this.
All right. Well, I hope you're enjoying yourself.
Well, absolutely. Anyway. Yes, I always enjoy talking about these things, but there's no gain in it for me.
Okay. So would you say, and this is again a very basic question, are you against organized religion?
No. And this is why I gave point number four it was earlier. It's because organized religion is a certain kind of understanding. It's not as high as the mystic understanding, but organized religion serves its place. It serves its place for those people who are at that level of development, quite simply. Now, questions, you know, there's this thing that goes on in your nationalist community, Christian versus pagan, you know, which is best for Europe? Well, you can have those debates, but for me, they're really besides the point because my concern has nothing to do with what is best for Europe. My concern is helping people out of their suffering by helping them to detach from their egoic identity. So, of course, religion has its place, and it may well be, and I'm sure it is, in fact, that societies are better off with certain kinds of religion, but it's not my focus, it's not my concern.
Right, okay, I thought so. Just to get one thing out of the way, I asked you earlier, but someone's specifically asking, which entheogens does McMurdo use, if any?
None.
Yeah. But and you also said shrooms earlier. You mentioned that people can ask about that, but I'm guessing that's not a topic that's of much interest.
No, all I wanted to say about that is what I already said, is that, you know, you have the right to do what you want with your own existence. I just don't recommend hallucinogens at all, purely because, again, you're making your so-called spirituality dependent upon a substance. Why would you want to do that when you are consciousness? You have everything you need right where you are.
Okay.
You see, okay, look at this in the chat. Yes, I can see your post. And he says, and with all due respect, sir, you are a pagan and at best a false prophet. Now, as you might expect, I get this all the time. But here's the thing. Here's why I will always, my message will always be more powerful than any religionist LARPing, is because all you have is your naked assertions. All you have is your doctrines and your dogmas. If someone came up to you and asked you to help them to come to know God, or if they came up to you and asked them to help them ease their suffering, you wouldn't have a clue what to say to them. Whereas I haven't given you ideas here, or at least not only ideas. I haven't given you dogmas here. I have pointed to an experience that you yourself can undergo if you are willing to. It's as simple as that. That's the difference. You give people ideas that you can't prove and expect them to accept them, whereas I point people to an experience that they can all undergo and therefore confirm what I say to be true. That is the difference between us. So you can say what you want, but people can experience, you know, what I point them to, quite simply.
That does remind me of what Terence McKenna said about shamans, that it is something that is self-evident once, but of course the gateway was taking psychoactive substances with him. But beyond that threshold, he would say this: the experience is self-evident to people. But anyway,
I must emphasize, I started with this, that this is not alien to religious traditions. I mentioned several figures at the beginning: Catholics, St. John of the Cross, St. Teresa of Avila. All of these people said the same things I'm saying, just using different terminology. But you religionists, even though they are part of your tradition, you won't heed them. You much prefer your doctrines and your dogmas, and I'll tell you why. It's because it costs you nothing. You guys love to run around proclaiming how loyal to Christ you are, because it costs you nothing to do that. It's just an idea that you express. And can anyone honestly tell me that this Christianity versus paganism LARP that goes on in nationalist circles, is it really any different from cowboys and Indians? Isn't it the truth that you guys very much like the aesthetics of these things? You know, you like the idea of the Templar, you like the idea of the Crusader, as if they are Christians that should be aspired to. You like the aesthetic, and you like to be able to claim that you're this or that, because you like to belong to a collective, but it really goes no deeper than that, does it? I mean, that's the honest truth in most cases.
I think that you might get people asking you, inviting you onto debates as a result of this. But I'll ask you a question that someone said this. You are consciousness, stop identifying with your egoic identity. This is opposed, that's paraphrasing you. And then he says, this is opposed to racial identity and national identity, and presumably any earthly identity. Would you agree with that?
Well, I always get this question. I would say, well, look at it this way. I went down to the shop earlier. When I go down to the shop, you know, when someone behind the till says to me, oh, hi, David, I don't say, my name is not David. You know, I existed before my name. That's just part of an egoic identity. No, I don't say that. I say, oh, hello. You know, our egoic identity is a reality. There is such a thing called Colin. The question is not whether that exists. It's not about pretending it doesn't exist. It's about not being so deeply invested in it. So, of course, you know, you can still have your egoic identity as you'd like it. But if you're so deeply invested in it, then your experience as consciousness is very constricted and you suffer as a consequence.
Right, okay.
And as for debates, by the way, there's a simple comparison I'd like to use. If you went on a voyage and you discovered a distant land, and then you returned to your homeland, would you debate the existence of the land you discovered? No, you wouldn't. You would simply tell people how to get there, and they would either do it or they would not. By the same token, because what I point to is an experience that you can access any time, I don't need to debate that because it's an experience. If I was just giving you one more set of ideas, one more theology, then that would be something to debate, and that's what religionists do. But no, I don't need to debate these things. You either make use of what I've said or you do not, quite simply.
Okay. All right. And here's a, well, another question. Would David explain his appearance? What is it meant to convey?
It's not meant to convey anything. The intention to convey something would be egoic, obviously, wouldn't it? I'm not concerned with how my appearance comes across. And I find it interesting. I would be willing to bet money that the person who asked that question considers themselves a religionist of some kind. Which is ironic because look at John the Baptist. He was out in the wilderness eating locusts. He was clearly a complete mess. And you'll notice that whenever religious figures are depicted, they tend to look this way. But it's not because that's how spiritual people are supposed to look and therefore they look this way. It's because spiritual people quite naturally aren't going to be so concerned with their appearance. It's really as simple as that. So, you know, I don't know what to say. If I was concerned with my image, I probably wouldn't look like this, but I'm not.
All right. Well, those are all the questions that I've got for you, and or that I've scanned in the chat. Somebody's asked, and I don't know if you'll want to answer this. What is David's day job? How does he put food on the table?
Web development, quite simply. Not since the lockdown, but that was what I typically did. That's, you know, where it all started. Remember when I was telling my life story, I told about how I was the marketing and media manager of that business. That got me, I mean, web development was only a small part of that, but it got me started off on that trajectory, shall we say. And so it's very convenient at times, but that basically.
Right. The guy who asked about your appearance, I think he is religious, and he says, John the Baptist pointed to Jesus. You point away from Jesus.
John the Baptist lived 2,000 years ago, and he wasn't pointing you to Jesus. He was pointing the people who lived at that time to Jesus. This is the perfect example of how Christians don't even read their own sacred texts properly. Let's take the book of Revelation. Even as I'm speaking now, there is someone applying the prophecies of the book of Revelation to events that are going on in the modern day. The problem is that the book of Revelation was written to seven churches that existed in the first century and that haven't existed for 2,000 years. The book of Revelation was not written to you. The letters of the Apostle Paul, while you can derive wisdom from them, they were not written to you. And so if you take those texts and you just make believe, which is what you're doing, that they were written to you and that everything they say applies to you 2,000 years later, well, you have all the answer you need as to why it is that Christianity and so many other major religions are in such a terrible state. I mean, you want to go out and convert people to your religion, but your own religion has serious problems. If your plastic Jesus isn't helping you, how is he going to be helping anyone else? Maybe your understanding is wrong. Maybe you should consider that. Just a thought. You don't have to.
Right. This guy is now saying there is a false idea of Jesus which you are using for your own ends.
Yeah, and if you go and speak to however many denominations out there, they'll tell you that you have a wrong idea of Jesus. But I haven't presented you with any idea of Jesus in this video. What I've said is that you can experience the consciousness that you are. The truth is that the divine, including Yeshua, cannot be encapsulated in a concept. Concepts and words can only point to the spiritual. You discover the consciousness that I'm talking about, then maybe you'll know something about Yeshua. Until then, you're just a religionist spouting dogma, and this world has no shortage of them, and frankly, this world has little use for them.
All right. Is David familiar with John Michael Greer? Does he have an opinion on his work?
I know the name, or I've heard the name, but I honestly don't know. I'm not familiar with him. There are certain people I expected to be asked about tonight, but no, I'm not familiar with that person.
Okay. One final question on this. Does consciousness arise from the brain, or is the brain a receiver of the universal consciousness?
Very, very good question. of course, the materialist, the philosophical materialist, and I don't use the word atheist because technically most Buddhists are atheists in that they don't believe in a deity, but most philosophical materialists would naturally say that consciousness is a product of the brain, whereas those with a supernatural perspective, they would say that, no, the brain is the receptor of consciousness. For me, the question is irrelevant. The important thing is that you can experience this consciousness. And in experiencing that consciousness, you can get all the answers you need. Because when you go to consciousness in meditation, say, you're on the doorway to what you might call the kingdom of heaven. I can testify of many major experiences that I've had dwelling in consciousness, which is what I like to do, which is why I don't have a TV, I don't have a mobile phone, I don't spend much time on the internet, because these things are just noise. I'd rather be in the silence that leads to consciousness. One day I was sitting right here on this couch and I felt like I fell through myself. I ended up in a dark ocean that was full of glittering gold. And it wasn't a frightening experience because this ocean I knew to be the being of God, but it wasn't really an ocean. It was just, that was just the way my mind was interpreting the experience. And I knew in that experience that I could swim in that ocean for all eternity in perfect joy, just discovering new things about the spirit of God. And that is the kind of experience you will have if you dwell in consciousness, the consciousness that I have pointed to.
Okay. Someone on DLive donates a diamond and says, I like this guest.
Thank you. You're one of the few, I'm sure.
But somebody else, Dharma Initiate, Dharma says, what you are describing is non-dualist Hinduism. You're rubbing people the wrong way by trying to separate it from religion. It's very clearly encoded in the Hindu religion. You are misleading people.
No, it's very clearly encoded in the Hindu religion, but the Hindu religion does not encapsulate it, and it doesn't have a trademark on it. It's encoded, as I said at the very beginning, in every great spiritual tradition of the world. Now, the name of that person would suggest that they are a Vedic religionist themselves, and that's fine. But most religionists would say the same thing. There are Christians in the chat who've been saying for the last hour and a half that Christ is the only way to God, and things that you'd expect a Christian religionist to say, but you're all failing to see the bigger picture, because going back to that comparison that I gave at the beginning of the video, you're all so concerned about the shape of the well that your particular tradition has built, rather than the water that all of those wells lead to, unfortunately. And I have no ill will, you know, that's just the way people are. You know, I've been speaking about this for long enough, I know the response I'm going to get, and that's fine. I'm just saying that you might consider that you've missed something somewhere along the way.
All right. Well, someone else says, this was a comfy stream, I liked it. So that's good. I comfy. Also like the
comfy. I don't think anyone would describe this as a comfy stream.
I think they probably enjoyed our interaction.
Right.
If nothing else. But I think that there's definitely a lot of food for thought and probably an introduction to a lot of new things for a lot of people. Although, of course, there are other people who are familiar with these topics and they are inevitably going to have disagreements.
Of course, yes.
See. So someone else says, I love this guy, fantastic guest. So there you go.
Oh, thank you.
All right, well, I have another guest in less than 10 minutes, so we'll have to end it there. But so, David, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial. I have wanted you on for some time, but I think there was a sort of misunderstanding about whether you would want to do it and on your part, whether you would be welcome on Millennial. So anyway, we've sorted it out now.
Well, I very much appreciate you giving me such a long time to speak, especially when you must have known that your audience was not necessarily going to like much of what I had to say, which was certainly the case, but I very much appreciate that you were brave enough to do that.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a very interesting stream. Are there any final words, any final things you'd like to say before we finish?
Not really, except that I always receive a lot of emails and, you know, I have a Curious Cat account that people would ask me anonymous questions on and I'd make videos responding to them. And I still get those emails and questions. But guys, honestly, everything you need to know, you don't need to give people money to go through various courses. You don't need to be buying books, not even the one I'm currently writing. Everything you need to know, I have said in the last hour and 55 minutes.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, David McMurdo. And I'll be back in about 10 minutes with, who is it next? Conquest by Concept. So that'll be quite different. Okay. Well, this has been an interesting one. So thank you, David, for taking part in Millennial 2020.
My pleasure.
All right. I'll see you all in just a few minutes from now. Bye-bye.